You may be seated.
Thank you.
Good morning. The second case set for the argument this morning is case number 30645, Arlene Egger versus Linda Egger Coyle. Richard Plummer is appearing, will be arguing on behalf of Ms. Egger, and Eric Schlemgen is present, will be arguing on behalf of Ms. Egger Coyle. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. Plummer, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You may proceed. Yes, go ahead.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, my name is Richard Plummer. I'm an attorney in Spearfish. I represent Arlene Egger in this case, who I will possibly refer to as a victim. An 89-year-old great-grandmother, married 21 years to Fred Egger, provided for their later years by accumulating some funds in a bank account that was held joint tenants with right of survivorship. Linda Egger, the daughter of the now decedent, sometime before his death, he was at home in hospice care in Mrs. Egger's home, removed all of the funds from the joint accounts. 100% of the money was removed from the savings account, and all but approximately $500 was removed from the joint checking account. That was funds that the couple had set aside for their retirement and elder years. Linda Egger held those funds allegedly under a power of attorney, a general power, held them in her name pending her father's death, which was imminent at the time. It was approximately a month later when he actually passed away. She held the funds for another month, deposited those funds into an estate account for which she was named as personal representative, and by which she and her brother would receive a substantial portion of the joint account if it was administered under the terms of the will. We brought this alternative action in addition to challenging the matter in probate court. Judge Fitzgerald, in a decision in August of 2023, found in favor of the personal representative. I attempted to appeal that. I muffed it. I failed to name an interested party, and you appropriately dismissed that case for lack of jurisdiction.
So is it really an alternative claim in addition to the proceeding in what was then an unsupervised probate, or is it an action that was filed in light of the lack of success in the probate action? Because the timeline seems to be that the dismissal that you just talked about in 30501, which was that appeal,
correct,
that was an October 8, 2023 order, and it looked like, am I right in thinking the complaint in this civil action is October 10, 2023, so just a couple days after, almost in the same time frame. So is it that it's alternative? Is it that it's in addition, or is it because we lost on the other one?
You're half right there. The conversion action was, however, contemplated and filed before, or prepared for filing before we received the dismissal on the first appeal. The alternative claim, which we attempted to assert through an amendment to the pleadings, claim for unjust enrichment, was specifically a response to losing out on that ability to appeal. But I can't really talk about this case without talking about the appeals that are currently pending in the probate proceeding. There are two appeals that are pending there. One is an appeal taken by the appellees from a decision of Judge Fitzgerald dealing with an abatement issue. And the second is a notice of review, which we had filed resurrecting the first appeal on the on the inappropriate transactions undertaken by the personal representative. So there are two appeals currently before you. And I will acknowledge, if you hold that res judicata applies in the instant action before you, I'm in serious trouble. I believe res judicata cannot apply because of the pending appeals before you, and then you later issued an order to show cause on the appeal that the appellees had filed, to which we filed a notice of review, raising the issue as to whether or not that was an appeal as a matter of right or premature, in that under a court-supervised probate, the right of appeal may not run until the order for complete settlement, until the entire estate is settled. So I suggest that res judicata would not become an issue if either you accept our notice of review and hear those interim types of cases now, or you determine that the appeals have to wait until there's an order for complete settlement of the estate, so that one set of appeals can come to you with all of the issues raised in the probate court. It would seem, and you've asked counsel for feedback on that order to show cause. I wasn't able to point you to anything definitive, although 29A3501 does seem to refer to a single in rem proceeding when you have a supervised administration, which would suggest that if it's a single proceeding, there would be a single right of appeal from that proceeding, rather than the hodgepodge intermediate appeals that you'll otherwise be presented with. I think that was the, if I'm reading correctly, that was the issue you left open in a footnote in the case of Smink, the second case, where you discussed the differences between, potential differences between the probate process in an unsupervised probate estate versus the single in rem proceeding that's contemplated by the supervised administration under 29A3501, which then leads to the order for complete settlement under 29A3001, which then has specific language that that order may be appealed at that point in time. So I don't really have an argument other than I don't believe the trial court in this case appropriately applied res judicata, since there had not been a final decision on the merits. You've been consistent in your holdings over quite a number of years that a final decision on the merits is a prerequisite to the application of res judicata. And that's what the trial court in this instant case primarily relied upon. In some cases, the trial court refers to it as res judicata. In other case, in other part of his decision, he raises a standing issue and disposes that under either a claim preclusion, issue preclusion. I really can't tell you the distinction, but it's the same concept as res judicata on this initiated self-initiated holding on standing issues. So if res judicata applies, I guess you would affirm. If res judicata does not apply because you're still considering how the appeals from this probate court would properly come before you, whether individually. If it's individually, there are two matters before you, one of which is the underlying decision that the trial court relied upon by Judge Fitzgerald. The other option is to dismiss the appeals currently pending and hold that only an order for complete settlement is an appropriate appellate route when the case is completed. So unless there are any questions, I'm not going to argue because I don't know what there is to argue about when the decision really is in your hands on how that probate process is going to be handled.
One of the things you raise in your brief is that the issues, regardless of the ultimate outcome of the probate proceeding, whether that's final, you argue that the issues are different that were litigated in the probate versus the issues in this case. Can you expound on that?
I did, but we tried to designate new parties. I learned my lesson on the Geyer appeal, if that's the right way to pronounce it, and made sure that we named everybody that was a party in interest. We attempted to bring in Jeff Coyle, that was the party that was omitted in service on the first appeal, which led to the dismissal. And we tried to focus on not so much what the estate did, because the estate's just kind of a holding party. It's got money deposited in its account. The actions preliminary to that, we felt a case of conversion would focus on the acts of the later PR while she was acting in her individual capacity and the errors that she made in connection with the misuse of the power of attorney. So I don't know if those are distinctions with a difference, however, Your Honor, because the underlying issue still would have required resolution of whether Linda Coyle, in any capacity, individual, as attorney in fact, or as personal representative, whether she had any capacity at all, but under which she could lawfully remove the joint tenancy funds under the power of attorney that she held. And we feel the law is extremely clear that she could not. So the conversion case tried to focus more on what she did before the estate was created, whether that's a distinction with a difference or without a difference, I can't tell you.
I don't see in the record any claim that Arlene was a contributor to either the checking or the savings account funds.
Oh, my goodness. For 21 years. I mean, this was the accumulation of their assets over 21 years. In the early years, Arlene was the sole contributor, including proceeds from a sale of a house. At that point in time, there was the accounts were held in a different bank. I believe it was Norwest Bank until the credit union was involved in 2021, I believe.
So the sale, there's a large deposit for $67,000. Is that from the sale of his shop, from the sale of the house? And the rest,
He sold during his lifetime, and that's where you get into the abatement issue that's coming up in another matter. He sold his storage sheds and his antique business. So if there is a substantial deposit, I'm guessing it would have come from him through for the selling of his business. The real estate was sold on a contract for deed, and that payment is I don't believe there was any substantial down payment on that. And there's also a rental house that Fred owned individually. All those assets we do not contest are covered by the will. But where you have the Uniform Power of Attorney Act simply saying, and the Guyer case saying, you can't remove, you can't take actions as an attorney in fact that will benefit you individually, as was the case here under the distribution under Fred's will, which does not carry any language that suggests that the will is intended to override the joint tenancy. But under the terms of the will, the savings account of approximately $197,000 is divided 50% to Arlene and 50% to Fred's kids, which include the personal representative. Does that answer your question? I don't think you get into a tracing kind of issue. The parties never attempted to identify, segregate. There was a joint tenancy checking account, a joint tenancy savings account, right of survivorship on both of those accounts. The personal representative says, yes, I knew I was destroying the right of survivorship so I could distribute it under the terms of the will. And we think where she has a beneficial interest, I think the law is very clear on that issue. That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Slimgen, you may proceed with the argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Schlimgen, and I represent the appellees, Linda and William Coyle. We are asking this court to affirm the circuit court's dismissal on any of the three grounds of res judicata, standing, and failure to state a claim.
What do you think your best argument?
I believe, Your Honor, it's res judicata.
Okay. Because 30501 is over? Because we dismissed it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's
in the estate case. Is that the finality? How else do you get finality?
Get finality from the lineage of the orders, the findings of fact and conclusions of law from Judge Fitzgerald, as well as the final order from this court dismissing that appeal.
Yeah.
I believe under Healy that was a summary judgment, and this court viewed that as a final order, and in Smink 2, the court relied on the Smink 1 decision being a final order.
And so that all came up, and we did that pursuant to a motion to dismiss in 30501, the initial appeal. That all came at a time in that during the estate where the estate was unsupervised, if I'm correct.
You are correct.
So that would have been a Guyer-type appeal at that point.
Absolutely. I appreciate bringing that distinction. I think that's the most important part here, is that at the time that appeal was taken, this was an unsupervised probate. And this court's noted in Smink, the Guyer-type finality brings with it an immediate appeal, and it implicates claim preclusion as a concept of res judicata. If it were otherwise, Guyer's exceptional final order rule could not be justified. It would foster successive appeals of individual orders, and parties would be free to recan arguments for their relief, limited only by their own creativity. This court in Smink talked about that not being the case, but there could be a case where there be successive appeals. I believe this is that case where this relief's already been asked for. It's been denied, and now it's not even within the same probate. It's a whole new civil action asking for the exact same thing already asked for.
Really asking for different relief. I mean, in the one case, you're looking to remove the. I mean, I get your point. It's founded upon the same facts, the same wrong. That's your argument.
Absolutely. When looking at the wrong, if you look to the settled record in the petition to remove 58 through 66 versus the complaint in the new civil action settled record 2 through 9, we went into our brief. It's basically a mirror image of what saying the wrongs were, the party, the conduct. The same relief is give us back the $280,000, which Judge Fitzgerald already said was taken with the authority of a power of attorney, was correctly put back into the probate estate, and you know that was requested to be appealed, and having the appeal denied by this court is absolutely a final order. It does not limit jurisdiction. Any error by the appealing party in that initial appeal would absolutely only be a non-jurisdictional claims processing issue, as noted by this court in the Hallberg v. South Dakota Board of Regents 2009 decision in a footnote number 3. That does not limit this court from jurisdiction. It's only an error of the party raising that claim. And the appellant counsel noted that was a Guyer defect. Not all the parties are added. It doesn't mean you get a second end run around to ask this court now to readdress those issues because there was some defect. You don't get to bring a new civil action. And as this court correctly noted, it was unsupervised at the time. It was the original appeal was filed under SDCL 15-26A-3. That was a final appeal from a final order. Had this been otherwise, the appealing party would have had to petition this court for an intermediary appeal within 10 days. That was not done. Under Guyer, under Smink, this was a final decision by the court in an unsupervised probate, and that precludes bringing up that issue ever again. That is what res judicata stands for. That's what this court talks about in Smink with Guyer having that, you know, exceptional relief. It absolutely then brings forth the claim preclusion aspect of res judicata that you don't get to do this again. The relief requested, the wrong is the same, the parties are the same, and any additional parties are really asking for the same relief and do not change or add anything new to the pleadings. They're just added essentially for trying to defeat res judicata or trying to comply with Guyer, as the appellant noted. Justice Kern, I'd like to answer your question that you asked the appellant. I believe there is nothing in the record before this court noting that Arlene made any contributions to the Highmark bank account. And that goes to the other two avenues this court has to affirm the circuit court of standing and failure to state a claim. The funds were removed by Linda Coyle, and she had the authority to do so as a power of attorney. But even if you look further, SDCL 29A-6-103 regarding the owners of a bank account, it's in proportion to the sum deposited. And in the pleadings, there's no contesting that the majority of the funds in that Highmark account were put in through Fred Ager's Social Security payments.
There's a large payment for large deposit, $67,000. What's the source of that?
I don't believe that's clear from the record. And even that amount is not, when looking at the whole $280,000, that's still not, if you look to proportionality of the $280,000, that's a small amount. And I believe that was something that was already fleshed out and determined by Judge Fitzgerald in this original underlying probate action, finding that there was no self-dealing, there was authority from the power of attorney to remove those funds,
No. Judge Strong took judicial notice of the record and the proceedings before Judge Fitzgerald. Is that correct?
At the appellant's request, Judge Strong did take judicial notice of all of the prior proceedings, correct?
And so what effect, there's testimony, and this gets back to res judicata, but there's testimony in the record that Linda testified that her father instructed her to take the funds out of the account. And what effect does that finding have by Judge Fitzgerald to the question before us here?
I believe it has no impact. Judge Fitzgerald made that decision. He was the trier of fact who had the ability to hear the witnesses, take exhibits, determine the credibility. He made a finding that she had the authority to do so. That finding was attempted to be appealed. The appeal was deficient. What effect that has on the second case is it's the same thing asked for in the first case. This court does not get to consider that evidence now, because it was already determined. That's res judicata.
So, yeah, that's, and I think that's what Justice Kern's saying too. It kind of loops back, because we're really, in this case, if that's true, if the judicial notice, and the cases do say that on a 12B5 motion, you can consider material that's been, you know, judicially noticed, but in this case, that makes the 12B5 motion a lot different than probably the more typical one, because there's evidence and findings and everything else. The effect of those ultimately probably loops us around to res judicata, and maybe we're not just looking at the sufficiency of the complaint. But if we were looking at the sufficiency of the complaint only, doesn't it allege conversion? She just has to allege that she had a superior right to the person who took it. The circuit court here and the circuit court in the estate case sort of have determined that Linda is Fred. But I'm not sure that's right. She's Fred's agent. And so the theory always seems to be, and whether we get that far or not, I don't know, but the theory is that she acted, as I read it, she acted unilaterally to take this money and either keep it from Arlene, use it to pay the expenses of the estate, diminish her ultimate recovery because Arlene wouldn't get it by virtue of the survivorship benefit with the joint account, or the survivorship feature. So that's what they're alleging. What legal doctrine or principle tells us that an agent is the principal? The agent acts for the principal. But who's to say that someone couldn't allege that an agent acted unilaterally using the power of attorney to frustrate a third party and harm them?
I guess I'd respond first. I'd ask this court not even to consider that. The time for this court to consider that would have been the 30501 appeal, which was deficient. For this court to consider it now on the grounds, I guess, of standing or failure to state a claim, the circuit court, Judge Strong, relied on those.
Yeah, put that off to the side, though, maybe for just a moment, because I understand your argument in that regard. And I'm just saying, isn't that a sustainable claim of conversion? You used it unilaterally, and you harmed me. And I had a better, superior right of possession than you did, acting unilaterally. And I'm not so much concerned about acting in their official capacity or not official capacity. I'm saying she just used this to act on her own to do this. Isn't that conversion?
No, Your Honor. The possessory interest of Arlene has not been proven to be any greater than that of Fred. And to be clear to the court,
but she's not Fred.
She's not Fred, but she took this action while Fred was still alive.
But the theory is that she shouldn't have, and she acted unilaterally.
I understand that. And the funds that were removed, there's been nothing in the record, as discussed previously, to show she had a greater interest in those funds in the account. And secondly, those funds aren't gone or used up. They are still being held by the probate. They're not diminished. She hasn't proven that she is deprived of these funds. They're still being held, waiting to be divided as the probate concludes. Does that answer the court's question?
Well, yes. Thank you.
We would still rely on the principles and maxims of res judicata on issue and claim preclusion, that there was a valid order finding a fact and conclusions of law by Judge Fitzgerald that was appealed to this court, and there was a defect from the appellant, and that ends this process in an unsupervised probate. There's no further remedy under Guyer or Smink to readdress these issues. Absolutely creates a public policy nightmare of having two courts try to assess what will happen with these assets. You have the probate court, and then appellants introduce a new civil action where a separate judge is being asked what to do with assets in a probate. That can't work.
Well, Mr. Plummer's argument seems to be that things kind of reopened again after there was a supervised administration in the probate proceeding. And so now you've got this ongoing proceeding in probate. Theoretically, somebody could bring up a removal of the personal representative again, things like that. Does that in any way cut against your res judicata argument, the notion that really this has now been reopened and it's an ongoing proceeding?
It is not, Your Honor. It stands for the principle of Guyer, an unsupervised probate carries with it an exceptional relief option of immediate appeal. Anything after it became supervised, yes, those issues are free to be brought on intermediary appeal or argued to this court at the conclusion of that supervised section. But anything that was appealed or discussed with a final order while it was unsupervised, that is res judicata. You don't get to, it would create another nightmare of, okay, I got it. Decision I don't like while it was unsupervised, I'll just move for supervision, then ask for the same relief again within the probate. And they've gone further here, not only doing that, saying, I don't like what's happening in the probate, I'm going to get a whole new civil action regarding these same things. For these principles, we'd ask this court affirm the circuit court on any of the three grounds of res judicata.
So in your view, then, there's no way in which Mr. Plummer, on behalf of his client, can seek review on the merits?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Plummer, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you.
And actually, Mr. Plummer, as you're making your way up, I'll start visiting, if I could. In that topic that we're just discussing right here with the Chief Justice and Justice Kern, you'd mentioned it in your earlier argument that the appeal that's currently pending. And I know it's hard getting into all these other cases that aren't this case, but you're really familiar with them. In that appeal that's already pending, you mentioned earlier that your notice of review was an effort to, I don't know, resurrect. I don't know what word you used, but something like that. That was an effort to sort of breathe some life into that appeal that had been dismissed, which was the denial of your motion to remove Linda as the personal representative. Did I hear that right?
Partially. Mostly.
Okay. Well, by all means, clarify that. But my concern or my question is, under what theory do you have? You know, Mr. Schlimgen just said, yeah, that's not going to happen under the law. And as he reads it, under what theory would you claim that appeal can be resurrected at all?
Primarily because the first appeal was never an appeal decided on the merits.
But we have time frames.
It was a jurisdictional issue that I lost the first right of appeal for my failure to serve.
But if Smink says anything, Smink 2 says anything, it says that Guyer means final in these types of cases. So that's it. I mean, that's your final order. You appeal it then. And I'm not saying that's definitively what we're going to hold, but I mean, that seems to be what Guyer says. That's your chance. That's your final decision. So how would you get another time period within which to raise that issue again?
Well, the first thing I want to point out is res judicata can only apply if you've made a final decision on the merits. You made a final decision on the jurisdiction. You did not make a decision on the merits. Under notice of review, we have the right to bring back to you. I don't think there's anything that precludes us from bringing back the same issue, which adversely affect us in the underlying same proceeding, back to you for a determination on the merits.
But unless it was a Guyer appeal and you had 30 days to do it after notice of entry and you're outside the 30 days.
We were outside of the 30 days for the right of appeal on the first go-around, 305-01. That's why we have 306-04 pending. The answer to the question, though, that's being raised is, can you apply jurisdiction where there is not res judicata, when there's not been a case decided on the merits?
Well, Judge Fitzgerald decided it on the merits.
Pardon?
Judge Fitzgerald decided it on the merits.
Yes, he did. That's why it's up for appeal. And I think that's why under the 5-29A-5-1001, in a single proceeding, these were not self-executing orders. I mean, the money is still sitting in the account. It cannot be dispersed until there's an order for complete settlement. Now, I assume that something like the law of the case might come about, that the order for complete settlement will incorporate Judge Fitzgerald's decision that affects both of us, and that you will probably have one further opportunity to review the merits of this and any other issues that come up in one single appeal. But I don't believe, as long as our notice of review is pending and as long as there is the order for complete settlement and the right of review that comes about because of that, I don't believe you can argue successfully that res judicata applies as the basis for dismissal of the conversion action. I'm a little troubled by questions relating to the individual contribution to the account. The statute and the theory that appellees cite would apply in a divorce case. I mean, you would then go through and do some sort of forensic accounting, and you could determine how much she contributed, how much he contributed. But there was no such claim asserted during the lifetime of either party that anything other than the laws of joint tenancy apply.
And that's the context in which I'm asking you the question, is within the laws of joint tenancy. You know, who has a greater right to the funds? If Linda is acting as her father's power of attorney and is directed by her father to go in and take the funds, does your client have a greater right? She's not claiming, I'm the sole depositor of those funds. How does she have a greater right? For example, a joint tenant can withdraw $1 or the entire amount. And so that's what I'm focusing on. Who has the greater right to these funds? Does your client have a greater right?
On death, my client has the absolute right to those funds because she is the 100% owner. And while Fred could have asserted some right of contribution during his lifetime, it can't be asserted after death. And you're acting, especially when you look at Linda's acting under a power of attorney that under Gear does not contain the right of self-dealing, does not give her the right to, under the Uniform Power of Attorney Act, to affect joint accounts without there being written, specific written language that says, you can make transfers that benefit you personally. You can make transfers that jeopardize or authorize joint accounts to be terminated, designate rights of survivorship. A power of attorney could do everything that you're talking about, but there has to be, under Gear, there has to be very specific written authority from Fred Ager that allows Linda to take the steps that she took, and there is no such authority there.
Your time is up.
Yes, it is. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted.